Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, it's Saturday morning and we've got the weekend together. What a joy. And that was the great Sashmo singing What a Wonderful World. And it is, isn't it? Even when we're up against it, as long as we've got people to connect with and love in our hearts, it is a wonderful world. And we have a wonderful guest today, Claire Bleakley. Have I said your name right?
You've certainly said it right. And it's so wonderful to be on this. I listen to you. I love your voice. I love the ability to bring out certain aspects of people. And it's so learning. It's really great. So thank you for having me.
Oh, bless you. And thank you for stepping up. Now, stepping up is something you do. I know you're standing up for me when you try and protect our food and nature from all the attacks that are happening right now. And so I want to start with a great big thank you to you, because without people like you standing up and fighting the good fight for us, we'd all be running around like headless chickens. But if each of us focuses on something that we believe we can really do something about, then we are a formidable army, aren't we? A formidable army of freedom people.
I see us as a patchwork. And so when we are all stitched together, look at what we can create. So I remember a good friend, Zen Honeycutt, from America, said, I used to sit back and say, why isn't anybody doing anything about this? And she realized that it was the me who was having to do something about it. And that, I think, is really, really important.
It so is. And Claire, for those listeners that aren't familiar with you, I've already heard you on RCR a couple of times. And for those that don't know you, can you give a thumbnail sketch of who you are and what you do in your life right now? And yeah, just a brief introduction.
I grew up in Kenya. Kenya, the heartbeat of Africa, it lives within you forever. I grew up with the most wonderful parents and three beautiful sisters. Due to the isolation, we lived at 10,000 feet on the Mau Plateau. And I went to school in Nakuru, and it was a boarding school. So I've been at boarding school since I was seven. I made lots and lots of friends, of which many have stayed in Kenya, but a lot moved to England. At the age of 11 and a half, I went to visit my school in England. And my journey probably started not so much there, but I had to have a series of vaccines. And I had a massive reaction and got grand mal epilepsy from there. So I had to just come to terms with suddenly having an illness that nobody really knew where it came from or how it came, but that's my story. I went to school in England. I did very well. I was very, very good at sport. And we had an Olympic-sized swimming pool at our school, which was St. Felix. And the Queen Mother came to open it, and I did the opening dive. Yes, so, and then Kenya got very, very difficult. And my dad said, let's move back to New Zealand. So he grew up in England, but his mother was embedded in New Zealand. So Granny comes from the line, we come from the line where we came out in 1817. And a Reverend John Butler is my great-great-great-great-grandfather, and he settled Kirikiri.
Wow. Just hold on a sec. That's amazing. I'm just absorbing this. So your great-great-grandfather was the Reverend John Butler. Did I get that right?
You did get that right.
Wow. What a pedigree, eh?
Oh, absolutely. But his daughter was two when she came out. And she was called Hannah. And when they went back to England, And when she grew up, she met a guy called Richard Barton, who settled Trentham, Heratonga, Barton's Bush. So this gets closer to us. So then his son was William Barton, and he came round to Featherston and built Fareham House. And he had five daughters, and one of them was my granny. And in the war, in those days, if you had a really good talent, she was an amazing artist. You went off to France to kind of finish. And she was lucky enough to be born with enough money for her to go to France. And that was just in the war. So she became a land girl in Herefordshire. And she met Granddad, who was a gunner.
Now, just slow down. You are now talking about your mother or your grandmother?
My grandmother.
Your grandmother, whose name was Hannah, right?
No, sorry. Annette.
Annette, okay. And she was a land girl in Herefordshire?
Yes. And she met Granddad because he knew how to work with horses. So they seconded him to take the horses as a gunner up to the big mountains in the First World War.
So which mountains was he taking them up? Do you know? Whereabouts was he taking them?
I think around the Gallipoli, you know, those big, I don't know, but in the war.
In France.
It could be France, it could be Turkey.
Yeah.
All he had to do was take the guns to the highest point, and he had to manage the horses.
This sounds like the First World War then.
It was the First World War, yes.
Right. Wow.
And then he came back and met Granny, and he was an architect, Edred Lutyens, under Sir Edwin Lutyens.
Oh, my goodness. We're walking through the pages of fame here.
We are. I know, absolutely.
No pressure here then, growing up with all of this around you.
Somehow you can see why the passion comes into you, because these people weren't arrogant people. They just had the most amazing look on life. And Sir Edwin's wife was Emily Lytton, and she actually hosted and brought Krishnamurti to England, and he lived with them.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so you can see that theosophical look. And Mum actually became a Quaker. Dad's side has this amazing look, this architectural look. And then on Mum's side, they're all doctors. And Granny, when she first started to be a doctor, she had to sit behind a curtain. And this was in England, and she was of Welsh, Corwin Bay. But then, so she sat behind a curtain, and Granddad sat in the front of the curtain. And by the time they had their 7 years or whatever it was, the curtain had gone. And she was one of the first women doctors to be registered in England.
So just pause here. I've got to take breath because I have just been whizzed through a great deal of amazing history that we've just landed in here on RCR. And in case you're wondering what you're listening to, this is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with me, Joe Pives. And I've got Claire Bleakley with me, who has volunteered to share the morning with us and to share her life. Thank you so much, Claire. Just in case the listeners don't know you, what are you up to now? We'll go back to the history later, but just tell me a little bit about your life now and what you do and, you know, what's brought you to what you do.
Okay, so right now I am being very, very active as president of G-Free New Zealand in trying to raise the awareness of what the real implications and of the destruction of our natural environment through GMOs is. And it's probably my past that has actually allowed me the strength to actually stand up and question. So what happened is every time something comes through, you question. And then if you don't get the answer, you start looking for it yourself, and then you can then do the research into that. And the problem with that is we as the consumer or the farmer or whatever will bear the brunt of any problems that arise. So we've stuck with the GE issue, the genetic engineered issue, and unfortunately, I think it's failing. Oh, it has failed overseas. So we are becoming buying the budget. We're going to buy the failures. So it's a bit like, you know, when you go in and you see a product that's almost out of date and it says buy two for the price of one. That's not being nice to us. That's actually just getting rid of product. And so we are really getting rid of dangerous products that have been invented by industry. And we are heading down a path, I believe, of destroying our environment, destroying the health of our people. And it's a spiritual, it's also the plants have got a spirituality and we have worked with them. And when we destroy their spirit, you will actually see that we're actually destroying our spirits as well, you know. And so for me, this is also a spiritual journey that we need to basically say to people, really, we've lived for the millennia with our environment. And now it's not climate change, it's pollution that's killing it. So it's man-made pollution. And what they're trying to do is say, we've polluted the world, and now we're going to try and fix it by making plants tolerant to that pollution so we can keep polluting the world. So anyway, I'm very passionate about it.
Yes, and thank you for your passion. And we will get back to the roots of that passion in a moment. But just for the listeners, if they want to find out more about what you're doing around genetically engineered foods and plants and all of that, where do they go, Claire? Where can they find out about this?
We have a website, which is fairly comprehensive, www.gefree.org.nz.
Brilliant. Thank you. And already we've dived into a great deal of your family's history, which is amazing. I think we'll need at least six sessions to unpack your family story, and the characters and the people there all sound worth about six or seven shows to me. But if we just come back to, you talked about, you know, architecture, you've talked about spirituality and Quakerism, and also an amazing connection with one of the last century's leading spiritual leaders, Krishnamurti, who in himself is an incredible story. And you've also talked about medical background, but you, I believe, were a homeopath. Is that right?
I am. And that probably is my passion. And homeopathy has been a real eye-awakening. I was, from my epilepsy, I was heavily medicated. And at the age of 14, they read the prescription wrong. And I ended up in a coma for 6 weeks and unable to walk. I had to learn to walk again.
Oh, my goodness.
And then what happened, what exactly was, I was in a coma, so I didn't actually know. So, but what then happened was the medication they put me on had a very, very narrow window. And if I was ill, it would tip me over and I get side effects. And so they had a very big difficulty just managing the medication and how accurate it could be without making me really ill. That medication was like living on a 40-watt light bulb. And the whole of you was just dulled right down. So when you needed your 100-watt light bulb, you couldn't concentrate. So for me to be able to say one sentence, it took a whole paragraph. And I still couldn't get the nut out. But inside my head, I knew what I needed to say. And so what happened was I met this amazing musician and got married and had my five children. And when my third daughter was born, we lived in Otaki. And I had what they call statuses. And that means you go into a fit and you never come out. And I had it three times within 3 months. And on the third time, I just remember lying in bed. And this doctor came along. I was so high on Valium, I was floating. This doctor came along in his white suit with a few interns following, and he picked up the notes at the end of my bed, and he looked at them and said, well, she's going to need a liver transplant because she's got total organ failure. And I thought, I don't know if I said it, but I thought, I'm sure I said it, I said to him, take me off the drugs. And he said, I can't, because you might have a fit and hit your head and die. And I don't know, I'm going to be on pills for the rest of my life. And when I got out, I did a St. Paul's conversion. I just fell off my horse and I started a health food shop. I went vegetarian, everything. So the family for 10 years had total vegetarian stuff, and it was a very much a born again situation. And I was able to cure my internal organs through good diet and help from naturopaths and people like that. And then with the health food shop, people who were sick would come in and say, well, this vitamin, what do you use it for? And I thought, oh my gosh. So I did a herbal diploma. And then I found I was pregnant with my beautiful fifth child. And I knew I had to keep learning. So whilst I was pregnant and while he was growing up, I became a homeopath. I didn't become a homeopath to save the world. I became a homeopath because the herbal medicine helped heal my organs, but I still had fits and I still needed to be on medication. And so what my journey was it was physician, heal thyself. So I, for 2.5 years, I withdrew very slowly off my meds, had the most horrific side effects. And I substituted it, went to a really lovely homeopath, and I substituted as I went down with different homeopathics. None of them worked until one day I went to a lecture and they were talking about a lizard, would you believe, that actually has copper as displacement in their blood instead of iron. And that helps them to concentrate the heat. And so they can keep warm longer.
Yes, they're a conductor, right? Copper's a great conductor.
Yes,
yeah,
that's right. And so, of course, when you have a fit, it's almost like an electrical surge. The conduction goes all wrong. So I went back and I looked in my homeopathic books because I was now a homeopath. I had just finished my basic training and I was now ready to go out and be mentored into learning how to work in the big field. And I looked, and the symptoms of Kuprum were identical to my fits. And since I took that remedy in 1995, I have not had another fit, thank God.
Wow.
And so my journey was, once I knew that homeopathy worked, I could then go out and say to you or any of my people, I can help you. I didn't feel I could be stoned out of my mind on pharmaceuticals and basically then try and heal everybody else. And so my practice has been busy, but not overly stressful. It is a de-stress for me. And I have to say, the people I see who share their stories with me and I'm able to help is probably one of the most blessed gifts I can give to this world. But as you would know with your massage, the whole of the GE issue is about health, of where we live, the spiritual health, the physical health, even the way we live, you know. And so within that, they dovetail beautifully. So one of them I can really defrag by just healing people and listening to these wonderful stories. And the other one says, no, you can't do this to me. So you get really, you get your strength from the fact that you know this is wrong. It comes with every pesticide, fluoride, 1080. Just what are we doing to our environment? What are we doing? Not so much to us, because we believe we can detox. What are we doing to the people, the insects that live within our environment? We're just killing off everything. And when you break it down, it's for money. It's not actually for the health of us. You know, every pharmaceutical you take is not necessarily for your cure. It's actually for money for them. You know, if it was in homeopathy and probably massage, the things we use is nature's gift to us. So we pay a minimal sum for the ability of that person to turn it into something we use. We don't need patents. We don't need massive animal experimentation on it, anything like that. We just need the knowledge that our ancestors have given us. And for me, that's a gift, a God-given gift. Yeah.
Goodness me, this is so beautiful. And I have to say, Claire, it is absolute music to my ears. I wonder how many listeners are also really enjoying this connection between your own journey, your history, and your journey of what sounds like vaccine-induced epilepsy, grand mal. And it sounds to me like, you know, that you've gone through, goodness me, what a journey, what a journey. And that all happened at such an important age of your life, didn't it? When you came to England and you had to take vaccines, what, to get into England or to get into the school?
No, it was, I think it was the cholera that did it for me. But to move from country to country in those days, you had to have a certain level of vaccines.
Yes.
And it was just a given. And cholera only lasted 6 months. And so you would have to have it. When I went to boarding school in England, I would go home for Christmas and for the long holidays. But from Christmas to the, because in England, of course, it's reversed, to the summer holidays, which was in, I think, July, August, there were 6 months where I saw nobody. And so I would have to have a vaccine every time I went back to Kenya. But then at Christmas, it was 6 months later, so I'd have to have another one. I can remember the cholera vaccine.
So what was it that lasted 6 months?
The immunity.
You were being given the cholera vaccine.
That was the one that came constant. At first, I just was given everything. And I think just the mixture of all of them is what tipped it over. But I remember when I was about 14, I had the episode where had to walk again. And then I remember standing on the doctor's desk. I mean, I was right out of it. And saying, if you give me that vaccine, I'm going to end up in the sanatorium. And her name was Dr. Leadham Green, and she really understood me, but she said, but then you won't be able to see your parents. And it was that lovely dichotomy of, I'm going to end up in the sand, but I won't see my parents if I don't do this. So there was a blackmail in it. But literally within... even though I was heavily medicated, within 12 hours, I'll be in the sand with a fit. It was fairly traumatic. And what I think was also very traumatic was I got it at an age where nobody understood it. So when I went to England, if I had a fit in front of my friends, it was so horrific for them that they were frightened to actually interact in a meaningful way. So I found myself basically withdrawing and withdrawing and watching people. So I got very good at being able to look and go, hang on, I know what that person's thinking. So I, you know, and you could feel it, and you might walk into the room, your room with all your colleagues, you would see that they were talking and they would all shut up, and you knew exactly that they had been talking about you. Even though it may not have been nasty, that sudden just silence, you just knew it. You just picked up that energy. And so you just learnt to observe the world from a more of a looking on the world rather than a friendship. I had three or four very good friends who actually turned out that they had the epilepsy in their families or something like that. So they understood it. But then when we came to New Zealand, we nearly weren't allowed because they said my epilepsy would be a drain on the health system. But because Dad was a New Zealander, we got in, but he had a bit of a thing. But my dad was amazing, and so was my mum. But my dad was a pilot. He started the first airline at the highest place in Africa, 10,000 feet. And when we came to New Zealand, he wanted to bring his aeroplane. So he flew it out all by himself, a Cessna 180, all the way to Aotearoa, New Zealand. And when he got to Lord Howe Island, there was an electrical storm. And it blew out all his instruments. And all he could do was mayday, mayday. And he had to think, do I go back to Darwin to mend and I've got no money? Or do I go on to New Zealand and then I've got the money there? So he decided to carry on the flight path. What he didn't know was a Qantas guy in his aeroplane had heard the mayday and had told Auckland Airport that this guy was going to do that. So they knew. And when he arrived, the whole airport was shut down. He had half an hour worth of fuel. And there's a photo of him getting off the aeroplane with all these fire engines, just in case he could do it. It was the most miraculous journey, you know.
How far is it? Just put me in the geography here. So he was flying on the leg from Darwin to Auckland. Yes. And how far was it from Lord Howe's Island?
I think it's about a 3 hour in a little aeroplane, 3 hour journey. So what he did, he went from Kenya, from Nairobi, through to Aden, across to New Delhi, down through Indonesia, through to Darwin. And each of these were refueling points. He took all the seats out and had a 40 gallon drum in the back. I mean, you imagine the fuel.
It's like flying in a sort of a potential bomb, isn't it?
It is. And that he's written his story, which is why I'm able to say it so clearly, of little things that went on and how when he got to India, the visa was all strange. But because Lutyens is quite known for the designing of some of India's architecture, his name got him through, and rather than that, so yeah, because he'd made contact with the architectural school there, so they were hosting him, and yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful story. I mean, I'm so blessed.
When was this, Claire? When was this amazing flight?
In 1975,
and he had, I'm just trying to get my head around this. He had this electrical storm, and he's still 3 hours out. He's got no instruments, and he's flying for 3 hours into Auckland without instruments. I mean, that is incredible.
Through a thunderstorm. I mean, what I'm saying is it was, yeah. He actually gave us a story. He started this airline, and these pilots one was a World War II, you know, big guy. Anyway, he started with one aeroplane, and because we were in Kenya, I'm sorry, Jerry, I'm going on.
You carry on. This is just amazing.
We were in Kenya, and because we lived in such an isolation, and to get to any hospital or anything like that, he had four beautiful daughters, and to get to hospital would take 2.5 hours. And one of the people who worked for him, we did have people working for us, he went and hurt himself, I think, doing something on the combine. And Dad was able to put him in the aeroplane and fly him to the emergency within half an hour. And it took about 20 minutes, half an hour to fly, as opposed to 4.5. When I can remember going down in Agatha, the Land Rover, through the most beautiful native forest, because the cedars of Lebanon came right down the Rift Valley. And we would have to stop and watch colobus monkeys jumping across the trees. This was in, I was born in 58, so it would have been about the early 60s. All the trees were just amazing. However, unfortunately, the Muzungu, or the white person, they needed charcoal for their fires. So this, all the cedars of Lebanon no longer exist there. It was all cut down for charcoal for our fires. But anyway, so we'd go down. It was just this most amazing escarpment. So you went from 10,000 feet to 6,000 in 40 miles. So it was very deep. But what was interesting was if you got stuck, you always took a picnic for 2 days worth of food, spare tires, everything. Because if you got stuck, you may not see somebody for two and a half days down this road. So you were very, very isolated. So that's why Dad became a pilot.
Wow.
And then he had friends in Nairobi. Brooke Bond was a travel agent. And she said, look, my mum's got a whole lot of friends and she wants to come out. Do you think you could fly her and they'll pay? So he went flying around all the game parks and then they went back to Germany. And so suddenly they said, why don't you start an airline? So it was called Sunbird Charters. And they used to fly people for 3 days in each of the game parks and move them on. Eventually, once all the places were filled, he had to get another pilot on board and on board. And one of the pilots, he's got a story where Serengeti is very close to Mount Kilimanjaro. So that's in Tanzania. And he was flying through, and Kilimanjaro has got a kind of a smaller mountain on the side. I think it's called, it's got a special name when they put out that little side bit. And quite often between the mountain and this side bit, there's a gap. And a lot of the tourists want to see Kilimanjaro because often she's covered with cloud, and they see this gap and they go down through it. But if they turn to the right, they'll go straight into the mountain, and many pilots have been killed. For some reason, Dad did this, but he turned the wrong way. And he said, if he turned the other way, they would have all been killed. But he somehow, something told him, and he went the other way, and they survived. And they saw Kilimanjaro from the bottom underneath her skirt rather than on the top of it. As he said, he was a very, very lucky pilot. God was with him all the way, you know.
Wow. But listen, we were talking about really your own journey into becoming a homeopath. And I was just recapping how this had been linked to, you know, you had to take the cholera jab every 6 months. I don't know why you're still alive. It's amazing.
I quite agree.
It's absolutely, given what you were put through in terms of vaccines and what we know about them, that's amazing. That is really like...
Well, I never had a vaccine until I was 11 and a half. And that is possibly why I had that such a big reaction. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe that's the reason you survived them, because you hadn't been weakened by earlier vaccines. Nowadays, they're having vaccines from very young age. And of course, it's weakening the baby's immune system and everything. I can't believe, I mean, you know, Sir Edward Lutyens is my great-grandfather, right? That's what you said. Yeah. Have I got that right?
No, great-great-uncle. But my
great-great-uncle.
Grandfather was an architect under him.
Is that your paternal grandfather or your maternal grandfather?
My paternal.
Your paternal grandfather worked with his uncle, right? He worked with his uncle.
That's right, yes.
Sir Edward Lutyens. What famous building did Sir Edward Lutyens design?
It was the Admiral's Palace in India. And, I mean, if you go Guildford, Godalming, Surrey, all that area, Hertfordshire, even all over the world, he did it with a lady called Jekyll. Gertrude Jekyll, and she would design the gardens and everything. So all those sort of orthodox gardens. He also designed the Queen's Doll's House.
I know why I'm connecting with him in a particular way, because he also designed some really amazing houses.
Yes.
And lots of even smaller houses had the Sir Lutyens, Edward Lutyens, Edwin Lutyens?
Yes, Edwin.
Yeah, had Edwin Lutyens Either he designed them or they were following his pattern that he designed.
The little mullioned windows.
Exactly. And do you know what? My father and mother-in-law of my first wife, they had a Lutyens designed detached house in Hertfordshire, right in that area. Yeah. And it wasn't a massive house, but it was just beautiful.
He was the beginning of stripping back and simplifying. But if you look at his chimneys and his roofs, they are so intricate. They're so beautiful. And you look at today's buildings and you look at buildings then and you just think, we've lost that beauty.
Listen, New Zealand is building sheds, not houses, right?
I quite agree.
Cattle sheds that'll blow down with the first decent storm. Certainly we got a lot of them in Wanaka, I tell you. It's like, as they build these houses, it's like, I'm looking at them and they're corrugated iron sheds. And I'm thinking, where are the cattle going then?
Well, it's really interesting because it is, if you look at society, that Gaia theory, what is macro and what is micro, you actually see that inability to have any creation, we're going to put you in a box. Everything is, we're going to manage you through these boxes, you know?
It's insane, isn't it? Whatever.
Isn't it?
It's completely insane. And it's contrary to human, contrary to the human nature. It's contrary to the human spirit. And then, you know, we didn't just get the architecture. We got Krishnamurti in there. Oh my goodness, Krishnamurti, what a figure. And he actually was amazing because in the end, he kind of told all his followers, in effect, to sod off, and he walked away. I think he's one of the few real spiritual leaders who said, I've had enough of this kind of fame game. He said, sort yourselves out. I'm leaving you. Is that a fair representation of what you know?
I don't know the ending, but I do know that when people sort of said, oh, yes, you know, could you help me here? He said, it's your journey.
Yes.
I am giving you some ideas, but you have to do it your way.
And which member of your family put him up? I remember reading about this.
Edwin Lutyens' wife was Emily Lytton, L-Y-T-T-O-N.
Emily.
And she did it.
She put him up, yeah.
I think while she was in India, that was her kind of, what can I do with my life? So she was a theosophist. And I think I read, but I'm not sure, that she chained herself to the railings with old Pankhurst. You know, she was one of that group.
Right.
You know, the suffragettes.
Yes, yes. So listeners, my goodness, we're walking through history here.
My mother also has a very great story because when Granny and Granddad met and married, they went off to Iraq. And who should turn up but Agatha Christie in her 1 week of absence when she disappeared after her marriage broke up. And became one of Granny and Granddad's best friends. And so she's my mum's godmother.
No way.
And during the war, they lived with her. That's right. And they would have dinner parties. And Agatha would say, I've got this idea. Do you think it would work? And Granny and Granddad would say yes or no, or they would discuss it.
Wow.
And so when you read her autobiography, there's a thing saying to Peggy, and in it, my mum's name was Crystal. And she mentions, yeah. So we've got a lot of artistic and spiritual way of looking at life that I think you absorb as a child, even though you're not aware. You're very aware of being yourself.
Spiritual osmosis, eh?
It is, absolutely. Oh, I just went to the most amazing homeopathic conference where we listened to a lady called Veda Austin on the memory of water.
Oh, I've heard about this and I was unable to get to her, but that sounded incredible.
I can send you her details because she is amazing. And what she does is she maybe has a little bowl of water and she will put either an intention in there or a picture of her face or whatever. And she did. She put a seed, a sunflower seed, underneath her bowl. She freezes it for 5.3 minutes. So the bottom is frozen, but the top isn't. Pours the water off. And a sunflower is the picture that comes up. So it's almost like the seed is got the memory of its mother or its whakapapa right back. And maybe the seed has the intention of where it's going to go. But when you look at that, you realize that Emoto, I think somebody interpreted him and said, we are 86% water. So when you meet somebody who's aggressive, it's your cells going, help, you know, you get the gut feeling. So listen to the gut feeling.
Oh, this is so important. We are really, we're discussing resonances, we're discussing frequencies, we're discussing how everything is interconnected, how we're water. Do you know, even in the neuroscience, they've discovered what they're now calling mirror neurons, which means that we resonate with whoever we're talking to, that we somehow pick up material from each other that we're not even conscious of. And our impact on each other is so important. But we're touching on things that I can resonate with and relate to, and I'm sure many listeners are. Just to go back to one of those little side roads we went down just earlier on, which was that your father, as a pilot, you said he wrote down all about that. Did he write it and publish it, or is it in just family archives kind of thing?
He gave it to each one of our children, each one of my sisters, yeah. So we've got it in a plastic-bound thing, yeah.
Nice.
Very cool, very cool.
Yeah, what an amazing adventure as well. And of course, I'm just going back to this because in 1975, it was the beginning of the jet age, but, you know, the DC-10s were coming in to New Zealand and all of that, weren't they? But to fly a smaller plane long distance is, you know, all these legs that you have to go through.
Oh, yeah.
You're flying a lot lower than the flights we have these days. And so you're experiencing a lot more weather.
Yeah.
It's quite an adventure. And I know this because in 61, my father left New Zealand and went back to England. And I know he flew, which was like an amazing thing at the time. When we, a year later, we were called back to England. So I was born here and we went by boat for 6 weeks through the Suez Canal and everything at the age of four, which was quite an adventure for me. But he described his journey, you know, and he said how long it was and how many stops there were. And even flying took a long time and was exhausting, you know, because you were flying, landing, taking off, refueling. It was quite the journey.
Yeah, it was. Just going back to that, when Mum and Dad got married, they went out by boat via South Africa up to Kenya. Yeah.
So you came back to New Zealand. Tell me what happened after that.
Well, I arrived.
And how old were you when you came back to New Zealand?
I was 16 going 17. And I arrived and my three sisters went to school in Wellington, Marsden. But I had finished school and I had not done that well. My medication had done me in. Anyway, so they thought...
Just to pause you there, sorry, I keep interrupting you, but I want to catch these moments because it sounded like prior to your vaccines, you were doing extraordinarily well in your schooling.
I was. When I first went to school, I was in that top stream of everything because... At a boarding school, you often will have streams because of the amount of children in the class. By the time I left school, I was in the bottom of the bottom. And that was all because of the medication, I have no doubt. So I come to New Zealand with a history and a biology, English, and I think geography. I passed, but I did very well the first two. And then... Mum said, I can't have you hanging around. We were in a old shearer's cottage. She said, I can't have you, so I think you need to get a job. So I went off to Wellington and stayed with my lovely aunt and cousins and went to work at a place called the Wellington Settlement. Now, that is the most amazing place. It had a pottery at the back, it had a gallery at the top, it had music and restaurant downstairs, and I was to just peel the vegetables. And one evening, my job when the kitchen closed and the restaurant had left was to feed the staff. And suddenly this gang of hoons came in and sat down and... Halef, who I absolutely adored, he basically said, Claire, Would you feed them?
A gang of what? What did you
they
say?
They were always, I didn't know who they were. There was about six of them.
But what word did you use?
A gang of what?
Hoons.
That's what I thought they were.
What's a hoon? You're talking to a newly arrived New Zealander.
No,
here,
that's so, an English so name. That's just some people who come in off the street. I thought they were just
hoons.
You know, they were...
I've never heard that word before.
Sorry. I think somebody might know what a hoon is, but they were...
Well, let's ask the listeners to write in and tell me.
That's right. Anyway, so these people come in and they all sit down and Herlof says, would you feed them? And I'm going, hang on, I've had a long day. I only feed the staff. Anyway, he said, come on, come on. I didn't know who these were. I was had been in New Zealand 4 months, you know. Anyway, so I fed them. And one of them was my beautiful husband. But I remember putting the plates down and saying, listen, if you want to be fed, you come in when the kitchen's open. And it turned out to be Blurter, Bruno Lawrence and the electric... And it was their thing. The son of the owner had basically, he was in the band, Chris Saracen, and beautiful, beautiful pianist, absolutely amazing pianist. And they had said, look, you can come in, have your food, but can't do it when service is on. I didn't know this. I wasn't told that. So I was really rude and I just, and Bruno said something back, and I looked at Patrick. I said, why do you wear your pajamas? And he had these jazzy trousers on, you know. I said, why do you wear your pajamas? Anyway,
and Patrick is your husband?
And yes, and so he said something. And they went away. And then in between working, you know, getting in doing their tours or their music tours, Chris and Patrick, he had a beautiful grand piano, and Chris would play the piano and Patrick would play the double bass as musicians for us. And they had a big, big dresser with a massive mirror from Lanark Castle at the restaurant. And I would look in the mirror and say, my God, he's really beautiful, this guy. And, you know, you're serving and you look up and you catch his eyes and you think, no, no. Anyway, he asked me out, and the story goes, basically at the age of 18, I got married. I had a baby, beautiful baby, and called Georgia, and then I had Bela, then I had Lulu, William, and then Alexander. And they were all blessings, all of them, my beautiful family. And Georgia and Bela I had quite quickly, and we travelled round on the bus. And it was just amazing. And in that, I met our best man was a gentleman called Fane Flores, or Michael Flores. And I became the godmother of their eldest daughter, Bonnie. But just that family is the most beautiful family. And Marion and I had our children together. And we flattered together. We didn't get on at first. I remember throwing a schnitzel at her and she threw the milk at me. She was a wonderful teacher in cooking. I think there's a special name for it. And I had done a cordon bleu course and we had a differing way of doing stuff. And eventually it just got to a stage where we were so frustrated with each other's different ways, then I just said, do it, and threw the schnitzel, and she went, boom, with the milk. We were covered. And do you know what? After that, we were best friends. It was almost like the tension had got so big that we needed to blow off and then laugh about it. And so Marion became a really close friend.
This is Marion Flores, yes?
Marion Flores, yes.
Yeah, and tell the listeners a little bit about Michael Flores as well, just in case they're not familiar.
So we flattered in Pai Kokoriki, and Patrick and Fane were best friends in Johnsonville. And they grew up and they became musicians and they joined the bands together. And they've got a lot of history of being bands together. But Fane was not just... a musician. He was the most amazing artist and really loving and just off the wall. He was a lovely, lovely man. Him and Patrick were the just best of friends.
And you travelled around with Blerta?
In a bus.
In the famous red bus, was it?
That's right, yeah. And then when Blerta sort of dissipated, a few of the members got together and there was a place called Rough Justice and they had a bus too. And we went round the bus in the Rough Justice. And then that was with Rick Bryant. And that then morphed into a second Rough Justice that Patrick stayed home to become a teacher. He felt that we couldn't rely anymore. Our children were getting to schooling age and stuff like that, and he had to become orthodox. I do have to say, I think at the age of 18, if I had married somebody in a suit, it would never have lasted. I needed to have that freedom, which I found with Blerta. And we used to go down to Waimarama, and there's the wife of Bruno, Veronica. She was like a second mother to me. She was amazing. So I had all these people. I had been taken away from all my friends, and suddenly I found a different load of friends who have become long-term, lovely, lovely people, you know, and I can't speak highly of them. And we don't really see a lot of each other, but when we see each other, it's like we haven't ever separated, you know. We just know each other down, down, down. So those two people, probably Veronica had one of the biggest impacts. She was Bruno's wife. So her family was a little bit older than my family, but we used to go for our summer holidays to Waimarama, which was tenting, children everywhere of all ages, close to the sea. And it was just the most amazing place. And they would always have music at night. And a guy called Jeff Murphy, he built a stage. So on New Year, we'd have this party and all the children would sing their songs on the stage. And then the band would get up and play and we'd just dance all night.
Well, Jeff Murphy's life story is a book in itself, isn't it? I mean, it's like what he went on to do and everything, the America and then with the Lord of the Rings and
yes. And
so much he got involved in. Yep. What a... Do you know, I'm just, my breath has taken away, Claire, because I feel like I've dived into some of the most amazing moments in history. And you were there or thereabouts all the way through. It's like amazing.
As I say, I've always got a thing, and it was Dad also said this. If you are asked to do something and you choose not to, then it's your responsibility for what the repercussions are. There's always, I wish I had. So now if anybody, I learned very early on, was my responsibility. So if I was asked to do something and I wanted to do it. And I say that to everybody. If it feels right, do it. Because you'll always regret not doing it, you know. And I think as you're aware of group therapy, we tend to stick in a group, and if one person stands up, everybody else can feel strong enough to stand up. So as time's gone on, I felt that in my journey, by me saying, I want to do it, or I can do it, or I will say this, what happens is everybody else has the strength to support you. So it's a little bit like that, as I say, that patchwork quilt, where you start with your center, but then all those other little patterns come around you. We do it differently, but we do it together, and we build this most amazing strength. And it's like what you're doing with here, you know. We can all have our own issues, but actually those issues, when you look at them, come from the same source, and that is power and control. And just one person stands up and says, you can't take my power and control away. I will do it my own way. Give strength to other people to go, actually, I don't like this. I will do it my way, you know. And so it is really important for, I believe, a few of us to do like what you're doing, have people to be able to explain why and how they do it their way. We don't have to do it the same way, but we do it our own way. And look where we go.
Well, I think there's a song about that, isn't there?
There definitely is. Absolutely.
Oh, Claire, I feel like you talk about a patchwork quilt. You've used that a rather beautiful image of the patchwork quilt because very often the patchwork quilt also carries segments of our family history and the many interconnecting lines. And I feel like what you've been introducing and sharing with us is, well, I feel a bit like I've been in a tumble dryer surrounded by bits of patchwork quilts from your life. And actually, I like that. I think it's almost like you've taken me in a walk through your life. And I know it's not complete, but we are actually going to have to finish. We've run out of time, but it's been such a glorious smorgasbord. That would be the word that comes to mind, of richness of images. And I'm sure the listeners will feel that they've taken this kind of whirlwind tour through not just your life, but how it interfaces with world history and indeed English history and indeed New Zealand history. One of the things I'm coming out of this with, though, Claire, which is really important, is one of the elements that comes out again and again in the way you talk is that our interconnectedness, not just with each other, but with the world, with nature, that none of us is, as it were, an island unto ourselves, that we're all deeply interconnected. Would that be a fair kind of analysis in a way of something that's important to you?
I think, like everything, when something is right, it is never you on your own. It's everybody who has helped you be who you are. And so all those experiences, all I can say is I've had so much support from my beautiful family, from my sisters, from my mum and dad, my grandparents, and all my friends, that they have been the ones who've held me up. But I have put their intentions into the way I feel I should live. And so too many of us, I believe, become pushed down. What we need to do is it's spring now, we need to sprout. And when we sprout, we might say I've planted my corn and it looks the same, but it's not. Each little corn is different. It has a different whakapapa. And so what we need to do is work together. And once you start to reductionalize and work in isolation, I think you go wrong. I think life doesn't follow really the best pattern for you. And I've always taken the easy path. If something's difficult, it's like the universe doesn't want me to do it, so I'll leave it to somebody else. And so you move on. And so my philosophy is I'm not going grey over somebody else's worries. And so do what I can the best. And I think that's what I would like to leave everybody with. You know, we are all very, very special people. And we all have our own stories and we're all shaped by our own stories. But actually, what we've been given on this earth is a real gift of life. So live life to the fullest.
Thank you so much, Claire. I'm just wondering, I do keep trying to focus in on how people deal with, well, two things. What gets you out of bed in the morning? And also, how do you deal with stress? How would you answer those two questions? Like the first one, what gets you out of bed in the morning, would you say?
The sun. Just the fact that I've got a new day and we've got whatever comes. How do I deal with the stress of that new day? I don't know if I deal very well, of course we all get down, do you know what I mean? But another saying that Dad said is never criticize anybody unless you have a better option. So his stuff was, always put forward your best foot, but never criticize somebody just for the sake of criticizing them. So what I've Dan, is my journey through university, which was very late, my homeopathy, my learning has actually allowed me to say, I don't like this, but I don't, it's not a gut feeling anymore. I don't like it because I do have the ability to say, this says it's not right, you know? And so in that, I deal with my stress, probably taking it out of my poor husband.
Now, as the Welsh would say, oh, now there's honest.
That's right. You know, I actually did feel there are two things we talk about. I always thought I might have been Anne Boleyn in another life. So I obviously identified very, very closely with her. But the other one I really loved was as a druid. When you dream, you have a silver lining and your umbilical cord goes up to the sky and gets all your memories for the day. I always felt that was something I just so identified with that. So dealing with stress is a very interesting thing because I'll get down, I might get really upset, but then something in me goes, the eternal optimist, you know, goes, actually, that's not worth going grey on. Just move on. And so I think for me, I've got a family. I've got my homeopathy. I've got my interest in the GE issues and all the environment issues. And each one of those I can select when I'm feeling stressed to change my perspective on what I'm doing, you know. And I absolutely think probably homeopathy is a de-stress for me.
Yes. Yes, I got that sense with you, Claire, when you talked about that. And I can absolutely relate to this, that somehow when you are just with someone and you're focusing on the journey they've been on, and I think this is something also about just feeling that you were doing something that was really close to your heart, that somehow you get enormous pleasure from, yes, helping someone. Yes, you're doing something really valuable in helping someone find their mojo, their balance, or whatever words we use. But there was a sense when you talked to me that I felt, which I resonated with, which was sometimes in the middle of everything that's going on, just to sit down and connect with this amazing, amazing medicine called homeopathy. Do you know, I think we could do 5 or 6 shows, Claire. I feel like if I bumped into you in the street, we'd still be there 3 days later talking.
You're most welcome to come down and visit.
Well, don't you dare come to Wanaka without letting me know. Don't you dare. I should be most upset if you were to come here and not touch base and connect with me.
I'd love to. I'd love to.
And I think this is also something that's important, which is, you do something close to your heart that resonates with you. And I almost have this sense, and it might be my projection, but I have this sense of when you do your homeopathy, you just stop and you are completely there and in the moment. Yes. Have I got that right?
Yes. Well, I think it allows me to take a breath and listen. And listening, I think, often you don't need to come out with any kind of, you should do it this way, you should do it. You just listen. And somehow the whole of that environment just comes together and in that one tiny drop. And it really is just beautiful. It's just beautiful.
Well, it's a blessing, isn't it?
It is.
You're talking about a blessing, and then you talk about your family, which sounds like another blessing.
Oh, yes.
And then you talk about your work with GE, which, you know, most of us would say, oh, this is such a tough battle. And yet I hear and think and see that you are never doing that alone. You're connecting and hooking up with good people. We're talking like this, you know, meeting people that you would never otherwise meet. I would never have met you but for the demonic behavior of governments. I even developed a new name for an illness. I don't know if you heard this anywhere, but I've got a new entry for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses called the DSM-5. And I thought, I've got a new name here, and it's called, are you suffering from the git? And the GIT stands for government-induced trauma. And I think we're all suffering from the GIT to some level or another. Whether we're aware of it or not, that's another thing. But those of us who are got our eyes open and we've got the courage to hear what's going on and see what's going on and listen to our hearts and to know that when something is going on that it's not good, it's not a good thing, it's bad. To know the simple difference between good and bad and to see the horror of what is going on. People who do that are my soulmates because they have the courage and the truthfulness and the integrity to see what really is, no matter how bad it is. And so I declare you one of my soulmates, Claire, because I can see that you do that. Oh. And to know that you're doing that over there where you are helps me over here to do it in this way. And we're all connected, aren't we?
Yes. Well, I just going back, we are certainly connected. And one of the things in life is when you succeed, you can take a step up. And it really helps you. And in 1999, the GE issue, they were going to put a human gene into cows to create a pharmaceutical through the milk, which they would isolate, for multiple sclerosis. And to me, it was an absolute travesty of justice. I just couldn't bear it. And as soon as they said they were going to do that, I walked down to the lawyers and said, I'm taking this court case. And we won it. My lawyer was amazing, absolutely amazing. And we won it on a technicality where the regulator, IRMA, the Environmental Risk Management Authority, what they did is all our concerns, they dismissed. And then they said the benefits outweigh the concerns. They should have weighed them before dismissing them. And they would have seen this. The other thing that we argued was that this was a science experiment, but there was going to be no science. They were just going to modify these cows. So what we got out of it was the experiment still went ahead, but we got into the ability for them to do annual reports on the health of the cows. Today, those cows suffered the most horrific cruelties and everything. And this government, this GIT, GITs, are ignoring all of that. And then later on, I put my house on the market. I didn't know anything. I just walked down and said, yeah, we'll guarantee my house. Thank God we won. We would be probably living with you in your garage.
You'd be very welcome.
Thank you. So, but what we did is we won that fight. And what we realized was actually the universe helped us. It wasn't, we have to recognize the power of each other and the power of what is right. And do you realize if we were eradicated off this earth, the earth would still live. But what she's saying is we would like to live with you. And if you carry on like this, we can't do it, you know? And so what we've got to say is it's not climate change anymore. It's pollution. It's human pollution that's killing this planet. Nothing to do with climate change. And maybe the climate is saying, I need to blow away the pollution. I need to wash away the pollution. So that whole Gaia theory of what is macro and what is micro comes in to whatever we're doing up here is actually happening on a smaller and smaller scale.
And we just have to know, don't we, that what they're proposing is not only anti-human, it's anti-creation, it's anti-life. That's all we need to know, exactly. And we need to stand
yes,
together.
Absolutely.
So if you want to find out more, go to www.gefree.org.nz. And support that great work, you know, because no one does this alone. And we all do this by helping each other. And when you've got someone in the front, like the bow of a boat, the bow wave, we need to get behind that because that's how we make real difference. So, Claire, thank you so much. We're going to ask you to come back and to talk through some of your music. But we're going to take a break now and I just want to say on behalf of many listeners who I'm sure will be clapping you right now for all that you do, thank you for sitting in the psychotherapist chair. Thank you for sharing your life, your family, your history, remarkable history. Thank you for taking us on a trip through some amazing world history and connecting us very deeply with New Zealand history. And more than anything else, just thank you for being you.
Thank you so much. This chair was extremely comfortable and I love talking to you.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.